Hi, everyone. I'm Raj Kumar, President and Editor-in-Chief of DevEx. This week, we'll be breaking down the big headlines in global development and bringing in some top experts to help us do it. If you want to follow along with the stories we're talking about, check out devx.com and subscribe to our daily newsletter, The Newswire. There's a link in the description. Follow us along on Twitter, and you can see many of the stories we're talking about today. And we'd love to hear what you think. This is This Week in Global Development.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Global Development. I'm Raj Kumar, the President and Editor-in-Chief here at DevEx, and delighted to be with all of you again, regular listeners and new listeners, for our program where we talk about the headlines, the big stories, what's happening in global development. And we do that with colleagues and with special guests. I'm joined today by Anna Goel, who is the Managing Editor here at DevEx. Hey, Anna.
Hi, Raj. How are you?
Doing great. Good to be with you. And I'm really excited by our special guest today, Soji Adeyi. Hey, Soji.
Hi, Raj. Thanks for having me. How are you guys?
Doing great. I think, people who listen to this regularly probably know you, or who read DevEx a lot know you as a leader in global health. You know, you're the president of Resilient Health Systems. You were at the World Bank for a long time, where you were the director of health. And you wrote a book, kind of a controversial, provocative book called Global Health in Practice, really pushing the decolonization of the sector. So thrilled to have you here to talk about some of the headlines this week, because we've got a bunch that are in the health space. And so maybe we can dive into those. A big talk of the town here in Washington, D.C. is the largest global health contract. It's really the largest foreign aid contract in history. It comes out of USAID. It's funding to deliver AIDS medications, malaria diagnostics. It's really a massive program, and it's the follow-on to a program that had existed for about a decade and really ran into a lot of trouble, as DevEx has reported. And that's the Global Health Supply Chain Contract. This new set of contracts are known as the Next Gen suite of programs, I guess aptly named, because they're a new generation. And some news came out this week about them. Maybe Anna, you can kind of give us a little backstory on the piece our colleague Alyssa wrote, and then we can get Soji's take.
Sure. Yeah. As you said, the Next Gen contracts, to be specific, they're worth $17 billion over 10 years. They're meant for USAID to procure and deliver health supplies around the world. And what we wrote about is this newest contract, which focuses on HIV/AIDS commodities. That comes with a price tag of roughly $5 billion. So we are talking some very serious money here. And when you're talking about this huge amount of money, there's also going to be fierce competition for it. It also raises the question of whether kind of the same big players, most of them based in DC, will land these contracts. And the experts that we spoke to think that that will mostly indeed be the case. One expert said that because lives are at stake, USAID will only trust a few people to take on such a big task. The contracts are also about sheer capacity. They are very big, hundreds of pages long. So it's really only big companies that have the resources to read and understand and apply for these contracts. Specifically, experts suggested that Palladium and GSI could be in the running, as well as Canomics. And this goes back to what you had said and what I'm sure DevEx readers know is our investigation into the previous global health supply chain, which was run by Canomics, which was plagued by mistakes, mismanagement, and delays, as we documented in our investigation. So it's actually why this next-gen suite of contracts has been broken up into 9 big contracts, so the agency doesn't put kind of all of its eggs in one basket. So, but it does look like that basket will be a lot of traditional legacy players that tend to nab these contracts. At least that's how it looks as of now.
Got it. Yeah. Soji, what's your feeling on this? And for people listening, you've been very involved in health systems. You've had to work on a lot of these issues. You know, you ran a major initiative around malaria. You've worked in Nigeria quite a bit. You had a role there on AIDS prevention. So you know the space really well. U.S. government's obviously a huge leader on funding for AIDS and malaria. When you look at these contracts, the way that they're being rolled out, what's your sense of it?
Thanks, Raj. My sense of it is in two parts. The first one is very brief, and the second part is a little more complex, and I'll try to be succinct in stating it. The first part is, well, maybe USAID somehow has some monopoly of knowledge that the rest of us do not have, and that is why they have chosen to go down this path, this $17 billion path. I really don't believe that. I think the second consideration is far more likely, which is that USAID lacks the institutional wisdom to change what it has been doing, which was clearly inappropriate and suboptimal. And as a result of that lack of institutional wisdom, USAID is doubling down or tripling down on its trial errors. What do I mean by this? DEVEX's own investigation showed the problems with the previous model. So I'm not going to repeat that. And I think USAID is committing this error of what I'll call escalation of commitment. They could do things very differently. How so? They could very simply subsidize those products at the factory gate, those medicines, those equipment. They could just subsidize them at the factory gate, get out of the way, and let the countries themselves or groups of those countries do the procurement by themselves. USAID has no rational business serving as a purchaser of commodities and awarding these unfathomably large contracts to U.S. contractors to go and deliver stuff in the countries. I think it infantilizes the countries. And most of the low-income countries and middle-income countries, they can do without those USAID-funded contractors coming to do things for them. So USAID is doubling down or tripling down on an error. And permission to speak frankly, I think this is an egregious case of institutional malpractice.
Well, you never disappoint, Soji, for being provocative, which is where we love to have you on. Let me try to push a little bit on your argument a little, because I'm imagining that people inside USAID would say, well, it sounds easy to subsidize this at the factory gate, right? They could fund, you know, the Vaccine Institute in India that produces a lot of these medications, let's say, and drive the price far down. But still, then governments in some of the countries hardest hit by AIDS and malaria would have to turn around and still pay. They'd have to buy these medications. They'd have to make sure they're delivered, particularly delivered to the most marginalized parts of their country, the most marginalized communities. Oftentimes, there's a lot of stigma around those marginal communities that might be most affected by these diseases. There are people in rural areas. And so I could see people at USAID saying, look, you know, it sounds good, but are we really going to achieve the development impact that we want to achieve? Are we going to kind of reach the last mile, reach those who are left behind if we were to just play in the market, you know, try to market shape here by driving costs down? What's your take about that?
I will say that if USAID ever said that, it would be intellectually dishonest of them. And the reason is the following. We have already blown that argument out of the water through the Affordable Medicines Facility for Malaria, or the AMFM, which did precisely that, subsidizing the then new generation of malaria medicines at the factory gate.
And you used to run that initiative, just so people are aware.
Yes, I ran that initiative at the Global Fund. And all we negotiated with the manufacturers of those artemisinin-based combination treatments. We subsidized them at the factory gate, supported the countries through some interventions, demand generation, clarifying the terms of engagement. Then we got out of the way and basically had the government and the private sector importers import those medicines to the countries, and we just rode the medicines, just rode the existing supply chains in the countries. And you know what happened? The prices went down, And to our joy and great surprise, the drugs actually reached very distant places. So it worked. The evaluation was published in The Lancet towards the end of 2012. But because this completely blew the USAID dogma out of the water, and because it was going to upend their business model, which had been captured by entrenched interest groups, the USAID and the US President's Malaria Initiative, through the US delegation to the Global Fund, bullied the Global Fund board to terminate the AMFM. That's what happened. So USAID has refused to learn, and they are throwing $17 billion of taxpayer money after a failed business model. And as an American taxpayer, I find that utterly revolting.
I know one of the main points that you've made, Soji, in your book, Global Health and Practice, is that African leaders, you know, we're particularly talking about African leaders because we're talking about HIV and AIDS, that they kind of see the game that's being played. And so they just move their budget around. They say, well, you know, we don't have to fund as much in health because we know USAID or the Gates Foundation or someone else will be there, kind of a moral hazard argument. And so they can move that funding into other areas that might have gone to health. And you argue that, look, if we gave them some tough love instead, they would actually fund these critical services for their citizens. But I think, and I'm not just imagining what USAID would say, I have spoken to people who are, you know, have a different view than you on this. And their feeling is we would be putting at risk the global population, the many millions of people who rely on these AIDS drugs, for example, if we were to experiment too much at this scale, and that we've got to sort of stick with what we know works. So I want to give you a chance to push back on that argument as well.
I think it's not a question of them sticking with what they know works. It's a question of what is going to be most comfortable for the guardians of the status quo. Now, the point is to have a time-bound and very explicit transition whereby funders like USAID, but not only USAID, will transition out over a finite period, and those countries will take responsibility for funding the most basic health services and the most basic commodities for their own countries. As it stands now, every savvy person in health and development knows the game. And what I hear is a variant of the following when I ask, look, why are you not putting more money into your health services and things like that? They say, look, we're not stupid. We know that all we have to do is nothing. And those North Americans and Europeans who love us more than we love ourselves will convene replenishment meetings complete with billionaire donors and expired soccer stars and semi-expired movie stars, and they would do a replenishment on CNN, BBC, and Franz Venkat, and the dance will go on. So I think USAID should end this delusion that it is indispensable and grow into the 21st century and gradually transition out of the business. It's a net liability to the countries. USAID is not a net asset to the countries. It's a net liability.
I think that, Soji, that's a really fascinating, the controversial point. I'd be curious to get your thoughts on, we've obviously got a huge debt crisis happening all over the world, but especially in the global south. And you have so many countries, including those in Africa, who are trying to, you know, service their debt. And that is siphoning money away from education and from health. Do you have any kind of empathy or advice in terms of the current state that many countries in the global south are facing at the moment?
Yes, I do have a perspective on this. At every level of income, there are variations in how much priority countries assign to health if you use their own budgeting as an indication of their priority. So there is a choice at every level of income. So that's one. A second is, I recall that some over two decades ago, I was actually involved in some aspects of figuring out how to channel funds from debt relief into health. And we wrote some technical guidelines at that time. I was at UNAIDS. This was money coming from the heavily indebted poor countries, or HIPIC initiative. So that was more than two decades ago. The question then arises, when they were not in a crunch, how much priority did they really put to health? Because if the argument is that because they're in a debt crisis, they would not be able to allocate money to health, one should then turn it around. That, well, you know, when you were not in a debt crisis, you were heavily reliant on and dependent on the Global Fund and Gavi and USAID and all those other actors. So it doesn't hold. So let me be very direct about this. Many of the countries that benefited from debt relief under the HIPIC initiative or agreement with the Paris Club, they have since accumulated levels of debt and continue to be dependent on development assistance for health. So, excuse me. So, in fact, while those countries will have greater capacity to spend more on health, if they did not have the debt, there are still large variations in the choices that they make. So it is not the case that the fundamental constraint on their spending on health is the debt servicing that they're doing. It's because they make deliberate choices. Their governments make deliberate choices to not spend more on health. And refusing to address that head on is an error that just gives comfort to continued misallocation of resources at country level. And quite frankly, many of the governments have appalling records in terms of misallocation of public budgets.
Are you looking for the inside story on what's happening at organisations like the World Bank, USAID or the Gates Foundation? Then you need to be reading DevEx Pro. I'm Jessica Abrahams and I'm the editor of DevEx Pro. Pro is DevEx's premium news subscription, where our expert reporters and analysts take you beyond the headlines, deep into the trends and institutions shaping the $200 billion aid industry. As well as all our news, you'll get access to conversations with global development leaders, resources to help you grow in your career, and a subscriber-only newsletter full of insider news and tidbits. See for yourself by getting a free trial today at devx.com/pro.
Another story this week. This is actually an opinion article written by Jean Kaseya, who's the head of the Africa CDC, and he wrote a piece for DevEx, really touching on the pandemic agreement that is being negotiated right now. And essentially his basic point is, look, the health systems in Africa are weak. There's a lot of inequality. Let's make sure this pandemic accord doesn't further that weakness and make that inequality, you know, even stronger. And, you know, as I think about it, Africa's in an interesting position now as they negotiate on this treaty. They have one big asset, which is surveillance data, right? If something happens, if there's an outbreak somewhere, they have the ability to decide whether or not they're going to share the genomic sequencing of a new virus, let's say. And obviously that's very important for global north countries, donor countries, to be able to take that information and maybe develop the next vaccine against what could be, you know, a global pandemic. So they've got this big asset, and it seems like in these negotiations, they're somewhat saying, hey, we recognize this and we're not going to give this away unless we get some of what we want, which includes, you know, domestically manufactured vaccines, which includes funding for their health systems. How do you look at this piece that Jean Kaseya published on DevEx? Soji, what's your take on it?
Yes, I read it with interest. And my take on it is the following. Let's go back to what happened during COVID, when the approach of a number of countries in a number of G7 countries, or if you like, for want of a better expression, the global north was something like, what is yours is ours, and what is mine is mine. I mean, that was the approach that they took during COVID. So fast forward to the current negotiations over a potential pandemic accord. Actually, I don't call them negotiations. I just refer to them as posturing. That's all they are, in my view. At its core should be equity. And that means when it's crunch time in a pandemic, it should not be dependent on where people live or how wealthy they are by accident of birth or accident of location. That's what it really should come down to. However, you still have a lot of opposition to that very elementary proposition, so that very basic proposition. So what does this mean more specifically? I think in a rational approach, yes, there should be open access, managed according to guidelines, to those biological samples and specimens that come from wherever they are in they might have been taken in the world. And at the same time, there should be open access to the information, the processes, and the products to fight the pandemic, be they diagnostics, be they therapeutics, be they vaccines. And those two have to go hand in hand. You cannot have a system in which an entity says, oh, countries in the global south, for example, must give up information on the biologics, but they will not do the same with whatever therapeutics or vaccines they develop based on information from those very samples. It gets worse because some of the arguments that you hear, especially from some of the large pharmaceutical firms, is that if they went that route, i.e. waiving the current regime of intellectual property rights, then it will stifle innovation. I think that is just laughable, quite frankly. Why? Many of those firms, the innovation they claim piggybacks on research that is publicly financed by taxpayers in countries like the United States. So the taxes that you pay and the taxes that I pay fund the research through the NIH and its affiliates on which those pharmaceutical companies then ride. And we don't have any evidence to suggest that you and I will stop paying taxes to fund that research if the intellectual property rights were waived in the case of pandemic. So it just does not hold water. Now, what to do? About a year ago, a group of us published a commentary in The Lancet. We called it Time for Ambitious Transformational Change to the Epidemic Countermeasures System. And we listed some core principles. We identified human rights. We talked about guaranteed equal protection. We noted national and regional resilience. And we emphasized a common goods approach. We emphasized equity and sustainable financing designed for impact. Now, on the political front, a problem with what is going on in Geneva is the following. I really think it was a strategic error to locate those discussions, negotiations, or what I call posturing, in Geneva under the auspices of WHO. I think they should have been in New York under the auspices of the UN General Assembly. That's where they should have been. And linked to that, I think it's a potentially missed opportunity to centralize the idea of a global health threat council that is pitched at the level of heads of state and government, such as the independent panel for pandemic preparedness and response originally recommended. So to summarize, I'm not putting much money on I'm not pinning much hope on the discussions that are currently going on. I will also not put much hope on anything led by WTO because WTO, quite frankly, failed. It failed the world, especially the low and middle income countries during the COVID-19 pandemic. And I think it is a very political matter that ought to be taken up directly under the auspices of the UN General Assembly.
Yeah, it's such a fraught issue now because you've got, you know, the politicization of the pandemic in the Western world, particularly here in the U.S. You've got a moment when there's so many other immediate and urgent requirements for Global North funding, Ukraine, Gaza, and obviously climate. So it becomes more and more difficult to generate the political support. You know, we reported last week on the pandemic fund and their efforts to raise more money and how there's a push maybe to create a competitor to it inside the WHO. It's just very, very hard to raise public health, global health funding right now. And so this adds to it, right? There's a sense maybe you just kick this can down the road. There's no pandemic today. We can wait. A fascinating discussion and really interesting, too, when you think about, you know, you mentioned the IP issues. And a lot of what I've heard during the pandemic from pharmaceutical companies and others who kind of take their position is that, you know, this IP stuff is mostly academic. That in the end, you know, you have an immediate emergency. Sure, you can share information, intellectual property about how these vaccines are developed, but nobody's going to have the ability, the technical chops to go and take that recipe and turn it into a successful vaccine in time for it to even matter. But things are different now because of mRNA. So I'm hearing from some people in the space, look, mRNA is the kind of technology where if you can, it's fairly modular. If you can deploy it in multiple places around the world and stand it up when there isn't a crisis, then you can very quickly turn it into a vaccine manufacturing site when there is a crisis. And so maybe potentially these IP issues will become much more relevant in the next pandemic that comes our way. I would love to get your very quick take on that, because then I want to take us to another global health story.
Yeah, I'm of the view that the pharmaceutical companies will put out the line that, oh, this is just too difficult for anybody to do. I don't think they're telling the truth. Is it challenging? Yes. Is it impossible? No. And that's why they are very, very much opposed to it, because they know it's doable. And they know it will level the playing field. That's why they're behaving that way. Okay. And by the way, while we're on the topic, there's a related matter, which is that of the R21 malaria vaccine. This is not the RTSS, the R21. I think it's a strategic error in global policy or constellation of actions to have a situation in which falciparum malaria is predominantly a problem in Africa. But now there's the R21 vaccine. I think it is just wrong to then have that vaccine be manufactured outside Africa, say in India, for example, and then designate African entities merely as distributors or marketing agents, and the most they will be able to do, as far as the eye can see, is probably fill and finish. I think this ought to be debated. It ought to be discussed more openly than it is now, because that's the route that things are set to go. And it ought instead to be a situation in which there is a clear path to which that vaccine will be manufactured from end to end on the African continent by African-based firms. So any entity, be it a foundation, be it a multilateral financing agency based in Geneva or wherever, that is pushing a strategy of having that vaccine manufactured outside Africa and then shipped to Africa is really not taking into account the fundamental interest of development in Africa.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point and an interesting story for us to pursue. Maybe, Anna, you could tell us about this other global health story we had this week that happened in India related to cervical cancer. What was the big debate that happened?
Yeah, it was really interesting. So there's an Indian model, Poonam Pandey. She faked her own death on Instagram and later revealed shortly afterward that it was a hoax to raise awareness of cervical cancer and the HPV vaccine that can prevent it. This obviously triggered a pretty big backlash, but at the same time, this kind of celebrity stunt did appear to generate, at least online, more interest in the disease, and particularly the toll that it takes in India, because India is actually home to 1/4 of the global burden of cervical cancer deaths among women. Screenings there are rare. HPV vaccine is private and therefore pretty pricey. Social stigma is high. So it certainly raised, well, let's say it garnered attraction, but whether it raised awareness is kind of another issue. We really won't know until long term. There's some people that we spoke to in the article who felt like if this was maybe coupled with a government campaign and some government messaging, it would have been more effective. Interestingly enough, there are plans for a national rollout of the HPV vaccine in India, but those have stalled. And actually, the reason a lot of us know that it stalled is because of this hoax on Instagram. So maybe it did in the end kind of serve a purpose, but it's certainly a controversial move to make.
Yeah, Soji, what's your feeling as a longtime practitioner and leader in this space about, I guess, cervical cancer broadly and how the world is addressing it, but also this kind of this way of sparking a debate in India?
Yeah, I mean, first, what is the central goal to which all can, on which all can agree, is let's do everything that we can to get every eligible person vaccinated against HPV. That really is that's the key. That is the public health imperative, and we're a long way collectively from achieving that. I'm not sure about the wisdom of an approach in which influential parties would issue false announcements of their own death as a way of generating attention. I appreciate that there'll be different perspectives on that. My personal take is that on balance, it just might be more useful to step into the arena and try to amplify positive messages through different channels to reach the audiences with which they are influential on the importance of seeking and taking up those vaccines and encouraging others to do so. I fear unintended consequences of erosion of public trust with such, shall we say, false announcements that are then retracted.
Right. Yeah, and it, you know, the story, it's a great piece by Catherine Davidson, and I recommend our listeners read the whole thing because it gets into the debate, and it talks about, you know, other disease areas, and, you know, another very famous Indian actor, Amitabh Bachchan, and how, you know, he has been a leader on health issues, and that the trust element is so key. And obviously, this doesn't exactly create trust. It might create attention, but it doesn't necessarily create trust. So it's worth having a look at that. We're fast running out of time. And so I think maybe we'll just talk about one more story, and then maybe next week we can get into another piece, because I'd love to make sure we come back to the special reporting you did, Anna, about CSW 68, the special edition newsletter. I recommend everyone take a look at it. We'll talk about it next week. But while we have you here, Soji, you know, we also published a piece that's been getting quite a bit of attention in the mainstream media around the sexual scandal at bridge schools in Africa and the World Bank's response, specifically the IFC's response. Since you're a former World Banker, you know the institution really well. You probably saw the piece that we published. World Bank's president, Ajay Banga, apologized to the kids who were sexually abused. I'd just love to get a quick take from you about what's going on here in this story.
Yeah, I read the piece, and several things are true at the same time. The first one, not necessarily in any order of importance, is one, look, these are children who are going to benefit from and education and all the subsequent opportunities that that could unlock. Two is that folks who work on education in the World Bank, these are, in my experience of working with them, these are first-rate professionals who are very passionate about what they do. They really care about what they do. Three is that you had this, what I would call bad actors who abused those children. And the head of the institution, as I understand it, has now issued an apology and admitted that mistakes were made. So where do things go from there? I see this in two or three dimensions. One, what are the implications for the model of funding of those schools? How might it be revisited such that the children benefit from an education, but they are safeguarded from such abuse in the future, i.e. putting into action the lessons learned. The other side of it, which your story also raised, is whether and how the children who have been affected are due any form of compensation. And I think the institution has a legal machinery and architecture in place to effectively address that. But overall, I think this is a teachable moment for everybody, and it's good that it's in the public domain.
Yeah, it's certainly a big story we'll continue to follow. I mean, it has elements of, you know, the question around how do you assure that these issues aren't just politicized, but that you actually focus on the ultimate goals here around both education and safeguarding children. But this is a highly politicized story now. It's very much in the news. There's also the issue about, you know, how do you compensate victims? What's the right way to do it? Should the World Bank be directly funding those victims, as some have called for, and as we report in the piece, or are there other ways to do it that would be more effective? And then I think, you know, finally, there's the question of, you know, what is the World Bank's role, and particularly the IFC's role, when it comes to funding private education in countries where private education is a big part of the model? And should they be pulling out? Should they be investing more? So I think there's a number of really interesting questions this raises that we'll continue to cover. Sadly, we have run out of time, as it's been a really fascinating conversation. Anna, any final thoughts from you before we close?
Well, there, we have an article, since we're on the topic of health, we do have an article today.
From me or from Anna?
I took over, so I guess me, but if you
hello?
Have any thoughts, please. No,
hello?
I was just going to, yes, hello?
Hello, can you
please
hear me?
Go ahead, Anna. Yeah.
Okay.
You're breaking up a little bit, but we're just going to hear a word from Anna before we close.
Yeah, I would just recommend people take a look. We have an article today on PEPFAR reauthorization, and that's an issue we've been following very closely for a long time. It has been extended, it looks like, for 1 year, but not the 5-year reauthorization that its advocates were hoping for. So this deals with the fiscal 2024 budget that's out, or that's supposed to be out very soon. And it just kind of follows this saga of PEPFAR, and we'll have some more stories on foreign affairs funding tomorrow. So I would just kind of urge readers to take a look at that, because obviously PEPFAR is such a huge health initiative credited with, you know, saving 25 million lives. So there's a lot at stake in the current talks on Congress, and that's another health story I'd keep an eye on.
That's great. Yeah, we'll come back and talk more about that next week. As usual, there's more stories than we can possibly get to. But it's been great to have all of you here for This Week in Global Development. Thanks for listening. Subscribe to the Newswire. My big thanks to my colleagues here on the line, Anna Goel, managing editor at DevEx, and Soji Adeyi, the president of Resilient Health Systems. And my thanks to all of you who've been listening in. Thanks, everybody.
This has been This Week in Global Development. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe using the link in the description. To get even more coverage and analysis on the most pressing development issues of the day, become a DevEx Pro member by going to devx.com/membership and signing up. Thank you for listening, and see you next week.